that we're seeing throughout Indian country. A new renaissance and the pride of being Indian, the dignity in being Indian, the interest in our Indian culture, Indian language, the kind of experiences that we've all had different kinds of reactions to, takeover of the BIA, the wounded knee situation, are all indicative of a discomfort that's kind of unpleasant feeling that's not only true for non-Indian America, but for Indian America as well. And you see different kinds of things take place over the last couple of years that are at least significant to me, but are also uncomfortable to me. For instance, a year ago, last February 3rd, 4th, and 5th, I had a meeting up in Lyons, Michigan with our four states of the Minneapolis area of NCAI. We had every kind of a segment of Indian country, young people, old people, militants, conservatives, reservation, urban, large reservation, and small reservation. We had a three-day session to kind of cover everything there was to cover, from Indian hunting, fishing rights to alcoholism and drug abuse. And we were singing along comfortably until the afternoon of the second day, when our oldest tribal chairman got up and out of the clear blue sky and said, you young people, he said, don't use the language the Great Spirit gave us to use, to communicate with, and to make decisions with. And he really just kind of stunned everybody, and I said, look, you know, I don't want to argue with you, and I don't want to be offensive, but look at this audience. You get all the factions of Indian country, young people sitting here that really admire you, that are really trying to get it together and trying to figure out what it is about being Indian these days, and where it is we go from here. You have militants and conservatives sitting here. But in any respect, I said, you know, there are certain things that young people are accountable for, and certain things young people are responsible for, and some things they're not. But those young people that you intended to be offended by your comments really had nothing to do with the fact that their parents either would not or could not speak the tribal language. And in my mind, they've been pretty kind to date. Because so many young people could turn to our Indian elders today and to you, I said, in a very demeaning kind of fashion, and say, look, where were you? Where were you when our folks are going through that kind of hassle, that kind of harassment, that kind of punishment for speaking our tribal languages in boarding schools across this country? But they haven't really said that. And if not, been known to say that entirely through this whole kind of hassle we've been going through, particularly in this last couple of years. And I think NCAI is part of that, as well as AIM, the National Indian Youth Council, the National Tribal Chairman's Association. All the associations represent respective constituencies in Indian country. And we're all kind of establishing our own kinds of roles throughout Indian country, what it is we do and how it is we do it, representing our own Indian people. NCAI's purpose and intent really hasn't changed much since its inception. It still operates pretty much as the kind of official Indian lobbyist in Washington, as kind of the official advocate for Indians in Washington, fighting that legislation and federal policy and program that happens to be adversary to Indian interests, and supporting that legislation and that federal policy and program that at least appears to be in the best interest of Indian people. But our whole makeup has changed. I'm different than past presidents of the National Congress. My executive director is different, Mr. Chuck Trimble. He's young, he's aggressive, he's bright, he's intelligent, he's had experiences both on and off reservations. He's a college graduate. The creator and past director of the American Indian Press Association. His heart is still in the area of journalism, but is doing a tremendous job as director of NCAI. Our executive committee is different. Four Indian lawyers are executive directors of NCAI, or I should say as area vice presidents. All of them with college graduate degrees, with the exception of two of our area vice presidents. We didn't have four lawyers in all of Indian country 4 years ago. The personality is changing. The kind of discomfort that some of us may have experienced and some of us may have felt with Bureau of Indian Affairs takeover and Wounded Knee, in my mind, is going to be short-lived. Nobody likes to go through that kind of experience. But in my mind, it's a healthy kind of change that's taking place throughout Indian country. It's not, in my mind, just militancy. Indian country, and I've discussed with some of the gentlemen at the table, you know, has one thing that was really ripped off from Indian people, really stifled, and that was our aggression. Indian people haven't been aggressive in many, many years in this country. But yet, you know, we go through the kinds of experience from day to day and watching the Washington Redskins, Blackhawks, Braves, you know, and everybody's impression about Indians that they're quiet, stoic kind of people. But those teams weren't named after quiet, stoic people. They were named after competitive, aggressive people. And that kind of desire for competition and to be aggressive is coming out once again. And maybe to the extremes of guns and weapons. But in my mind, it's a healthy kind of change in the Indian country. And one that I've looked for a long time. And in my mind, in a couple of years, when it tapers off and levels off, even though it's going to be a little unpleasant, a little uncomfortable across Indian country and across the United States. And what you're going to see, in my mind, is a beginning of diminishing the number of suicides across Indian country, diminishing of the amount of suicide and alcoholism and drug abuse. Because a new kind of sense of competition, a new sense of pride, a new sense of aggressiveness, in my mind, will change to become more and more politically astute, politically aggressive. Aggressive in the classrooms, aggressive on the streets, aggressive in sports, and the music, and the arts. You'll see more aggressive tribal councils across this country, because any young people are changing. And there aren't any young people that I've seen lately who you and I are going to be able to blame 25, 50 years from now and say, "Where were you? Where were you when our people were going through the hassles of today?" Because the attitude is changing. We do understand that we can compete. We can be aggressive. And we look at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, you know, it's not as crime, hey, they destroyed our bureau. Because one thing our people understand, and our young people understand, the National Congress understands, is at least the attempt to destroy and attempt to improve and attempt to modify the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and as much as it's been changed to date, is the first semblance of an institutional change in the 20th century. There's no other institution in the 20th century has changed. Not government, not bureaucracies, not welfare, not penal institutions, not judicial institutions, nothing. And least of all, educational institutions. And all the institutions that to date have been partied with the federal government, and in my mind, in carrying on the continued genocide of Indian people. Genocide that began in this country with destroying almost all of Indian country. A genocide that many people in this country fail to remember. Everybody remembers the ovens at Auschwitz when 5 million Jews were destroyed. Nobody remembers the genocide of Indian people, nor the continued genocide of Indian people today. Not genocide anymore at guns and soldiers, but by law, legislation, and policy. By termination. So what's termination? Termination is a funny kind of thing in this country. The Congress and the government has some sense of an idea that they can just write off Indians. And they can say on a piece of paper, "Look, your reservation no longer exists. And you no longer are an Indian people." That's legislative genocide. That's destroying Indian people. We have legal genocide in this country, in the courts. We haven't had a favorable decision by the Supreme Court of this country since March 24, 1971, the date of the famous and infamous Eagle River decision that subjects Indian water rights to state courts, the beginning of equating Indian property with other federal lands, the beginning of an attitude in courts that said our lands are public lands and not private lands, and ownership is inherent in the federal government and not in the private right of the tribe. The termination no longer just takes an act of Congress. was simply the stroke of a pen of a secretary or the president, who has no desire and no interest and no concern for Indian country. A president who very recently is on trial, and his administration's on trial. A president who said just 2 weeks ago on Armed Forces Day, in trying to justify the continued bombing of Cambodia, the reason for continuing the bombing, he said, is that we insist that any country that makes an agreement and an obligation must live up to it. And Sam Irvin, the judge, and the jury, and the prosecutor, said March 13th on the Senate floor in explaining why the Senate should not ratify the Genocide Convention being pursued by the United Nations since the early 40s. He too said, any country that establishes by treaty or a contract must own up to those obligations and must live up to those treaties and those obligations, even if they have to be in opposition to the best interests of that country. Otherwise, why make treaties? So both the judge and the defendant in this case both express the same ideas. And to Indian country we say, you know, what difference does it make? What difference does it make to Indian country? The president who's on trial, the judge who's trying him, both have the same attitude and the same mentality. You bring that to Indian country and they'll say, well, ho-hum, what's new? Because that's been part of our history in this country, that same kind of mentality. It's not just the Watergate situation that's on trial in this country. It's the whole mentality of modern America. The whole history and conscience of America is on trial. And not just be the administration, but the entire government, the entire body politic ought to be on trial. Just as we in any country think that it ought not be the Indians that ought to be on trial at Wounded Knee, it ought to be the federal government that's on trial. Because the kind of existential in this country, the kind of expediency in law, humanity, and morality is the same kind of expediency in existentialism that's killing Indian country. So hopefully that the Watergate and Ellsberg cases just won't be passing fancies for Indian country, but they will in fact begin to be a turning, a sense of morality, and a sense of humanity, and a sense of justice that will have its effect first on the first Americans. Because it really can't take place in this country. There can't be any real change unless this country first owns up to its responsibilities and commitments to its first citizens. Senator Sam Irvin, recognized as the Senate's leading authority in the Constitution and constitutional law, went through 8 pages of testimony explaining why the Senate should not ratify the Genocide Convention. You know, he's the author of the Indian Bill of Rights and the Civil Rights Act. That's also killing us. And systematically, in my mind, not by coincidence, avoided mentioning the Indian community in this country. Because the Indian community in this country is the only community that this country's government, its legislature, its judicial, judiciary, and its executive branches could ever be guilty of attempting to destroy. And yet in 8 pages of testimony, he mentions the black militants, the Black Panthers. He mentions criminals in the courts and in the jails across this country that have killed other people. He mentions Vietnam veterans and Vietnam casualties. But he failed once to remember and to mention Indian country. And that, in my mind, was no accident. We're looking at a funny kind of transition in government. We think, really, at this point in time, that this is the best time and the most opportune time for Indians to begin to take its case before this country, where the president's on his knees, Congress is upset and disturbed, and the American public are finally beginning to feel some pangs of conscience. Some pangs of conscience that in our minds hopefully will at least give Indians the same kind, the same level of attention as other endangered species in this country. I said before, and I'll say it again, that maybe that's about what we have to do, to declare ourselves an endangered species. Then we get the attention of all the animals you see in this museum right here. Whooping cranes, pelicans, bald eagles. And maybe the kind of attention that a year ago this spring, when everybody got excited throughout the world, particularly in the United States, the Sierra Clubs, the naturalists, environmentalists, and they all panicked when the starfish took over the coral reefs of the Pacific Islands. In 24 hours, Congress appropriated $5 million to see what was wrong. Let any country try that, to support and defend and provide for its own Indian community, and ask for $5 million. And you get some idea of the mentality of this country and a sense of humanity. No different yesterday, for instance, we were talking about the environment and man and how Indian country fits into that kind of sequence. Some guy said, you know, many, many reservations across this country couldn't support its people and establish a viable economy on its basic resources. He said, you know, when we talk about that kind of thing, we talk about birth control. You know, I say I really get aggravated at things like that. Because I said, then you know, there are half and more the population west of the United States, west of the Continental Divide, who are living in unnaturally impacted communities, all living and expanding off Indian water. People in Denver, Albuquerque, Phoenix, Tucson, Vegas, Reno, and Los Angeles that don't know that when we turn on their tap and fill their highball with water that they're killing Indians. They don't know that. But nobody says, look, Los Angeles is also a community that couldn't support the people that are there with its basic resources. Neither could any of those communities. But it's not right for Indian country. We got to practice birth control. No other people in this country, no other nation in the world, has given so much and received quite so little in return as our Indian people in this country. Who else do you know made room for 200 million other people? Nobody in the entire world has made that kind of provision. Yet these very same people who provided the land and the tax base for this country have been systematically ignored and systematically denied the Bill of Rights and the protection of the Constitution that this country is built on. And people get excited and Prescott angry and say, you know, why are you Indians so upset with the Bicentennial Commission? So look, how can you possibly celebrate your 200th birthday party and not discuss Indians and involve Indians? So what's really the issue? I said, what do you mean, what's the issue? I said, you're celebrating your 200th birthday party. We provided all the presents and didn't get an invitation to the party. That's the trouble. A land that was built on the bodies of 5 million Indians. We're coming to a situation today where maybe we're lucky. And we've been lucky a long time in Indian country. We've been lucky that American business and government has extended its interest to other countries. And we're not isolationist so that Indian country was not totally exploited and destroyed. We've been lucky that wars have been fought outside of America. We're lucky now with the Watergate and Ellsberg and little bitty ways that lots of people don't understand. But my right hand on the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Mr. Bill Veeder, the guy who really raised a consciousness in Indian country about genocide, thievery, the crooks in government, the conflict of interest. Those issues the government has been party to. We've always been running all these years, you know. We've known how they've been doing it to us. We never knew how. But we know now. And little Mr. Veeder, ready to retire, and he's being investigated because he happens to be an advocate for Indians. That's going on. And thank God for Ellsberg. And thank God for the Watergate. Because maybe now, Mr. Vita, we can survive and save for maybe another year to protect and advocate the interest of Indian water rights across this country. That's going on simultaneously to Watergate and Ellsberg right now. The rest of Indian country is in a funny kind of state of affairs. This is the first time most of us can remember that Indian country hasn't had anybody to address itself to in Washington. No commissioner, no secretary, and no secretary of interior for all practical purposes. And so we find ourselves in situations like Russ Means coming out of Wounded Knee to visit with Lemon Garment. I said, I mentioned at the dinner table, you know, nobody, he and I normally wouldn't spend the 10 cents to call him. But since nobody else in Washington addressed ourselves to, that's the point of departure. But it is changing. There's no question, as it wouldn't be, that tribal governing bodies across this country need reform. But so does the rest of America need reform. Indian tribal governments are very visible to everybody that lives on a reservation. We talk about reform, every country needs reform. When you talk about government, nevertheless, you're looking at a government in this country that has modeled itself after Indian government, and ironically didn't allow Indians to be self-governing until 35 years ago. Indians have been self-governing, in fact, for probably 15 years in this country. Because just when we were about to get organized in the middle 50s, we were then threatened with our extinction. But Indian tribal governments are coming up once again. They're getting younger. They're getting more aggressive, getting more sophisticated, as Indian people are everywhere. The visibility of Indian country is very real these days. The consciousness of America about Indians has been raised extensively. But you know, the government had a funny kind of thing when they passed the termination policy and established the Relocation Act. There's really some feeling that Indians would then become out of sight and out of mind. But as you all know, Indian country's visibility has increased, almost doubled the numbers of Indians that moved into urban America. The visibility is there. We are not out of sight and out of mind. And in my mind, we're going to be leaders across this country in politics, but particularly in giving this country the last opportunity to begin to really develop some sense of humanity, a new sense of credibility and integrity and honesty. And urban America is particularly unique. We're going through a situation these days where Indians are not only confronted with the black-white civil rights mentality in this country. That doesn't leave much room for Indians and other minorities. But the urban mentality as well. We're first generation urban people. And people in urban America don't understand Indians. I worked for a school system in Minneapolis who was posturing an immigration desegregation program. And Indians are saying, all right, the blacks and whites want to get it together, that's all right. Don't involve us. But we're trying to get it together too. The different bands of Chippewas. Chippewa with the Sioux. And the Sioux with the other 265 tribes in this country. We've got to get it together first. Because we're not just Indians. And I'm not just Chippewa. The Red Lake Band of Chippewa. And we have our clans that delineate who we are and what we are. We're at this point in time the only people in this country. When we take away our titles and addresses, we know who we are. And urban people don't understand that. We don't want to move into urban America and, like the rest of America, strip ourselves of everything unique about us. We're willing to move in. We're willing to compete, but on our own terms, in our own due time, and with everything unique about us. Because it wouldn't be such a hassle in urban America with our kids in schools. We have 3,000 Minneapolis school system. And our kids would have to day-to-day be harassed. Hey, why don't you guys do your dance? Because Indians shouldn't be a novelty in this country. Because the Irish kids, and the Swedish kids, and the German kids, and the black kids, and the Chicano kids also ought to have their own kind of dances and language and cultures. But people in this country systematically strip themselves of everything unique. So that Indians wind up being a novelty, and everybody else zombies in urban America. It's a tough kind of existence in urban America. as tough as it is in any country, to maintain that same kind of existence. No different than we said in our Indian country, we want to retain our Indian lands. They're our birthplace and they're our birthright. No Indians run to urban America, but everybody else in this country has run from somewhere. From Europe, from Scandinavia, from South America, they've all run from someplace and somewhere. But any country's not running. They've got no place to run. We're home, and you're an Indian country. That kind of analogy is tough to get across to the body politic in this country, to the bureaucrats, to the courts, and to most of non-Indian America. And we're willing to move in, but we are going to retain what's unique about us. Indian country has three major kinds of obsessions. Retention of our existing tribal lands is one of them. The other is that this country will one day finally own up to its commitments and its treaties and obligations that it's made with Indian country. So that's something that Senator Irvin says, and President Nixon says, President Johnson said before him, President Kennedy before him. Those obligations and commitments are to be lived up to. And a third primary interest that affects all of Indian country's existence, and that is the protection and provision of the most fundamental of all civil rights, and that being the right to survive as a people and as a culture. We're going through a funny kind of transition. And we've got new Republicans these days in Indian country. We used to have all Democrats. This year we got lots and lots of Republicans. And we've got Indians in schools across this country that are really proud to be Indian. We've got Indians in politics. We've got Indians in the committees in Congress now that are affecting our very lives from one day to the other. Franklin Ducheneau, Cheyenne River Sioux is now with the House Subcommittee on Indian Affairs. Forrest Gerard of Bakhti, the Senate Full Committee on Indian Minister Affairs. Your new man, Sherman Broadhead, with the Senate Subcommittee on Indian Affairs. So we're making progress. It's slow, but we're making progress. And Indian organizations across the country are beginning to form and define their roles. No more conflict. As you know, Indian country is kind of funny. NCI, being the oldest organization in the country, has always taken the brunt of new organizations' attacks. When NNIYC came about, the National Indian Youth Council, its first one of departure was the NCI for not being an advocate for Indians in off-reservation boarding schools. And NCI said, you know, we can't do anything for everybody. Then the American Indian Movement came along, and urban organizations. The first point of attack was NCI. We had a very real split the year that I was elected president of NCI in Reno. Right on the convention floor, just like your two aisles, the reservations went to one side and the urban to the other. A kind of split that had been brewing for many, many years, particularly from the last 5 years. But that kind of thing is beginning now to settle down. And recently the Tribal Chairman's Organization was formed. They said we were becoming, you know, too cosmopolitan. Two unresident off-reservation Indians, young Indians, militant Indians. The chairman's organization is former. It's an older, more conservative organization in age. But everybody has their roles defined these days, and it's been uncomfortable. NCI's got its particular role, AIM has got its particular role, NIYC and now the chairman's organization. Much more clearly defined today than they were a year ago. All except the fact that communication is not all so good all among them. My communication with AIM is very good. I met with Clyde Belkert last Thursday night. I met with NIYC people Friday night and Saturday. The chairman's organization hasn't been too accessible. They're more accessible to the administration than they are to any country. It's been a difficult kind of a proposition for all of us. But at least the communications are improving. The organizations are improving. They're getting more mature. And the kind of people we're getting in our organizations are really making a difference across Indian country. We We are becoming more sensitive about ourselves. Tribal governments are becoming more and more sensitive about their own existence and why they, in fact, are in existence. Young people are becoming more and more aware of who they are and what they are and where they're going. And I have experience from one day to the next with young people, next day with guys in prisons. I'm never very sympathetic to young people, whether they be in schools or in prisons, because I tell them, look, you're no good to me, nor to Indian country, nor to colleges. You're no good until you get out. So please hustle up and get out. And to the guys in prisons, you do Indian country no good behind bars. We need warriors. We need spear carriers. Get yourselves out. We need you. So you get a different kind of a relationship out in Indian country. We begin to see the relationship now between urbans and reservations. It's not a division experienced by Indian country, but one imposed, superficially imposed, and imposed by non-Indian people. Because one thing that's happening, you know, we begin to become more aware that it's not just urban Indians and reservation Indians, but that practically a third of our Indian community is in rural non-reservation communities. Practically all of California, large part of the state of Washington, all of Oklahoma, many of the eastern tribes are rural, non-reservation, non-urban people. They too need advocacy. They too need help and support. So you're seeing a new kind of an awareness, a new Indian Press Association, Indian Country's AP and UPI. We're seeing legislative review that's been the most sophisticated review of legislation affecting Indians in this country and in our history. And we're seeing new kinds of newspapers, new kinds of media. Akwesasne Notes, Wasaha, sophisticated news media and newspapers. But Indian country's mentality is changing. We've got nearly 80 lawyers these days. We're increasing the number of doctors. 10 years ago, when I was in school, we had 1,000 Indians in college across this country. And now we have almost 15,000 today. New teachers, doctors, engineers, Indian architects, architectural firms, management firms, consultant firms, businesses. So we are changing. And it's comfortable and it's fun. Yet we've got a long, long way to go. The place where we need the most help, always, is with Congress and legislation. The place where we can all help now is with making Watergate real throughout the country, making it work throughout the country. No more adults kidding their children and playing adult games about what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. Because that's a large part of the difficulty of this country dealing with Indians. The same with the treaties. So I wasn't there 150 years ago. But that's not the point. And the point is, what's right? And what's right then ought to be right now. And what was wrong then ought to be wrong now. But that's not the mentality of the bureaucracy. And it really isn't very funny when Indian country looks back at the first Americans. And I mean the first immigrants. That came over in the first boats were not the cream of the crop. They were crooks, and they were thieves. That mentality of government in the bureaucracy hasn't changed much, at least as it affects Indian country. So you can help us to straighten out this government so that it really does, in fact, become responsive to Indian country. And once becoming responsive to Indian country, then it seems to me it ought to be going in the right direction for the rest of America. But at this point, it's got a long way to go. But I mentioned Chuck Trimble, my executive director. Chuck has been making a few speeches on his own lately, and I'd like to just give you some idea of some comments he's been making. And I think really apropos today, and I think apropos of the kind of machinations that Indian country is experiencing with government. He said, in addition to showing the world that deplorable conditions in which our people must live, Wounded Knee pointed out some painful truths to all of us. It showed the vulnerability of tribal government to take over. Not only by dissident factions, but by a contemptuous federal government as well. It showed at least one tribal chairman that despite the phony respect accorded him in official circles of the nation's capital, there are damn few people he can depend on. And he showed the wrath of a silent people when angered and frustrated by a system that has done so little for them. He went on to say that, he said in testimony before the House Indian Affairs Committee last month, and of course numerous times since, he said, I spoke of the tactics of the administration to effect long-planned changes in the Bureau of Indian Affairs without the least of consultation with Indian people. He said, we have seen the administration refuse to restore the services of the Bureau of Indian Affairs since the takeover of the central office. Their ploy is to bring the Indian community to its knees, begging for the good old days. It is our understanding that waiting in the wings are old-line bureaucrats who will immediately assume the reins of leadership in the BIA as soon as the Indian people are ready to concede that anything is better than nothing. In my mind, Indian country is not going to let that take place. Indian country will not let the BIA Humpty Dumpty be put back together again the way it was before. In my mind, it's not only going to refuse, but it'll make it something different. In my mind, it would be an historical setback if Indian country were to allow the BIA to go back to the good old days. We don't need that kind of existence anymore. Indian country really has the opportunity and the initiative and the responsibility to be self-determining. And it wants to be. For Indian country, for myself, and for the National Congress, now is not a good time to die. Now is a good time for a victory. And we need your help, as much as we need the help of all of Indian country, to reshape the federal government and federal government's policies, to reshape the body politic, to reshape America, mostly America's sense of humanity and sense of morality and sense of justice. So that if there's going to be a change and a new direction in this country, it ought to begin within in America. Now we go through these kinds of exercises and speeches and presentations, people always kid me for being too serious. But these are serious days. We're facing very, very critical days in the country. When I talk about the mentality of government, the crooked courts, the apathetic Congress, and the totally nihilistic administration, it's really that way when it comes to Indian country. I talk about the possibilities of administrative termination. That's dangerous. It really is, in fact, the most dangerous time in Indian history in this country. Because we really are fighting for our lives and for our survival. The precedents being set in the courts and by this administration are the most dangerous we've confronted since the Indian Wars. So we need your help. We need your support. We aren't going to do it by ourselves. And hopefully when you address yourselves in Indian issues, that you won't respond, you know, trying to retain your Indian lands and exercise futility, like I did, had a person say to me yesterday. Because you guys, you know, no question, are economically and politically less powerful than the rest of America. Because we really wouldn't be, if there was even some sense of strength of what's right and what's wrong in this country. It's not a question of being economically and politically less powerful. It's a question of morality. It's a question of integrity. And it's a question of honesty. Indian country will survive, both on and off our reservations, in urban America and rural America. They'll survive only as long as this country will at least begin to demonstrate that sense of humanity. And I can't repeat that often enough, because in my mind, that's the issue in Watergate. That's the issue in Ellsberg. And that's the issue in finally abating and stopping, hopefully, the genocide of Indian people in this country. We want to live, We want to survive. We want to retain our tribal lands. And we want to help this country own up to its responsibilities and commitments. But with that, you know, I said again, we are going to be a little bit serious. I had a joke that I was going to tell Mr. Wispa to address you, but I heard a funny one the other day. You know, Indians still got a funny sense of humor. Among other ways of being unique, they got their own kind of humor, I think. But I was up in Sisseton, South Dakota last Thursday afternoon on my way here, really. And these two Indian guys had walked into the employment assistance office looking for a job. And they saw a sign on the wall that said, wanted two men for rape. They looked at each other and said, hey, we won't be able to do that, can we? Yeah. Let's look at the job description. It said on the job description, wanted 200 beggars. Hey, those Winnebagoes get all the good jobs. Thank you.
Mr. Cook says that he will field any questions you want to throw it. Do we have any? Yes?
That's fine. Depends on whether you're a bureaucrat or an Indian. In Indian country, we recognize those that are recognized by their Indian community. The federal government still, some other, holds, try, at least tries to hold the Indian community's existence and an identity to being one quarter blood. The last census estimated we had 887,000 Indians. Recognizing the efficiencies that we've seen throughout Indian country and throughout our reservations. I really have an inclination to think that we have more like 1,200,000 Indians in this country, and I think if we really did an accurate census, I think we'd find that, and we'd find it even more to be like $1.4 million Indians. Yes, sir.
How much Indian blood does a person have to have from you personally to consider an Indian?
That's not a question to Indian country. Indian community will accept and identify and consider anybody who's Indian that his community and his peers will accept. We have no problem with that. We have that question raised, you know, by lots of people. And one of the things we're going through that's particularly difficult these days are those Indian kids that have been adopted by non-Indian kids. We find this all over the country. That people have adopted Indians, you know, and Indians have been kind of in vogue in the last few years. That also happens to be one of the forms of genocide that I think is really criminal. We lose about 25% of our kids a year. Illicit and illegal and subtle forms of adoption and foster home placements. That 9 out of 10 cases simply are a case of an Indian person or Indian parent being denied due process of law. But the children that are products of those families now have parents that are coming to say, hey, look, you know, our kid is Indian. We'd like you to help us, you know, tell them, give them some idea of what it's all about. And I said, look, you know, I'd like to have an injection, some kind of a pill. So that kind of lifestyle is not something that you just pick up overnight. But most of the kids that I've seen, you'll find most of the kids in our juvenile centers and all that are Indian kids are there, and 9 out of 10 will be from foster home placements where they just don't seem to fit. And they don't seem to adjust. And in my mind, it's understandable. But at least you find that kind of a thing happening. In terms of the original question, you're in the community, you know, will accept you. And it's no hassle. You're not going to find anyone in the street questioning whether you're a quarter blood or full blood or whatever. It used to be, even the kind of thing we went through for a couple of years past of the apples and the radishes and that kind of thing. We stopped that kind of thing, hopefully, and because I think it's a disease. I think it's a sickness. And it's a sickness that just really gets my goat because I've seen so many times that people have criticized Indians in college and guys in the street when they get down to the hassle, even our own militants. And you've got Russ and the guys past at this point in the game, you know, where they criticized Indians in college, but when it came to writing proposals and meeting lawyers, there weren't any Indian lawyers and Indian technicians that they had to call in the wire. So what didn't make a hell of a lot of sense. But so at this point, I think we're past that game. I think we're past, you know, playing with that kind of sickness and questioning who's really an Indian country and who's really red on the outside or white on the inside or whatever. It doesn't make any difference. We haven't got the kind of numbers of people to question and to criticize each other. So we need every soldier we can get our hands on. And Jim Zavar defining anybody that identifies with any community is certainly not to be turned away. Marvin L. Franklin is supposed to be an Indian, but I think like most Indians, they've appointed to the new jobs, they're all acting Indians. Marvin Franklin, in my mind, has been in the affairs of the mental midget. That's my own personal opinion. But I had predicted it. In fact, I'll read you something. I wrote to Webster Tuhart, just now that you asked the question, about, I thought I brought it with me, but I guess I did. Anyway, I wrote to Webster Tuhart January 10th of this year, and he was at that time one of the possible candidates for the position of commissioner. Yes, I've got it. I said a few weeks ago I had a conversation with a number of tribal chairmen from across the country. They were trying to ascertain what was going on in Washington, D.C. concerning the Administration of Indian Affairs, namely the next assistant secretary and the next commissioner. Dickie Wilson, chairman of the Ogallala Sioux tribe, was one of those chairmen. I mentioned the possible list that was rumored at the time, your name being one of those thrown around. This is to Webster Tuhart, president of National Tribal Chairmen. Dick asked, what about Jim, Dr. Jim Wilson? I told Dick that he had to be kidding himself if he thought Jim had a chance. I told him it was my feeling that nobody would be appointed to as commissioner that had any initiative or imagination, both of which Jim has, but that it probably would be someone who was relatively ignorant about the BIA, or someone familiar with but very conservative and likely to maintain the old status quo. As the assistant secretary, I told him that I was pretty sure someone pretty much of an autocrat would be appointed to that position. In my mind, Marvin Franklin fits both of those. So, you know, I don't say anything but the bureau in my mind of